Beauvais conference. But Einstein soon developed new thought experiments, doggedly pursuing the problems he saw with quantum physics. At the next Solvay conference in 1930, Einstein presented Bohr with another thought experiment, an imaginary contraption evolving a spring scale with a box full of light hanging from it, timed with an accurate clock. Bohr, again, thought that Einstein was trying to get around a quantum uncertainty principle. After thinking for a while, Bohr revealed that Einstein's thought experiment failed because he, Einstein, had forgotten to take his own theory of general relativity into account. This episode has become a legend in the history of quantum physics, Einstein hoisted by his own petard. But in reality, the problem was with Bohr. Einstein's thought experiment in 1930 was never intended to get around any kind of uncertainty principle. His complaint, once again, was locality, just as it had been at Solvay 3 years earlier. According to his friend, Paul Ehrenfest, Einstein absolutely no longer doubted the uncertainty relations and had developed this thought experiment for a totally different purpose. Bohr had once again missed the point. Several years later, Einstein came back with yet another thought experiment to demonstrate his concerns about locality, one that would resound for decades. Einstein and two colleagues, Boris Podolsky and Nathan Rosen, published a paper in 1935 with the provocative title, "Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete?" This paper, known as the EPR paper after its author's initials, is sometimes depicted as Einstein's last desperate move in his showdown with Bohr. The truth is far messier and much more intriguing. The EPR paper, on the face of it, isn't about locality. Ironically, it appears to be a way around the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But instead of devising a way to measure the momentum and position of a single particle directly at a single time, as Einstein had purportedly done in his earlier thought experiments, the EPR paper goes about it indirectly. The thought experiment, at the heart of the paper, imagines a pair of particles, A and B, which collide head-on, interact in a very specific and delicate way, then fly off in two opposite directions. Momentum is always conserved. It's a basic law of nature. So the total momentum of the particles is fixed over time. And because of the way the particles interact, the distance between them at any time is easy to calculate. In Newton's physics, this would be like two identical billiard balls hitting each other head-on, then bouncing off to opposite ends of an enormous pool table. Because the total momentum of the two balls has to be zero, knowing one ball's speed and direction would instantly tell you the other ball is moving at the same speed in the opposite direction. Similarly, finding one ball would allow you to calculate the location of the other ball if you know the time and location of the collision. In quantum physics, the situation is a little trickier. According to the Copenhagen interpretation, particles don't have properties like position or momentum, or anything else until those properties are measured. But, EPR argued, measurements made on one particle couldn't instantly affect another particle far away. So, to get around the uncertainty principle, just wait until particles A and B are very far apart, then find the momentum of A. Measuring A's momentum lets you infer B's momentum without disturbing B at all. Then simply measure the position of B. Now you know B's position and momentum to arbitrary precision at the same time. Therefore, argued EPR, a particle can have a definite position and momentum at the same time. But because quantum physics doesn't let you simultaneously predict the position and momentum of a single particle, EPR argued that it must be incomplete. There must be features of the world that quantum physics doesn't account for. The EPR paper closes by holding out hope for a better theory that can account for those things. While we have thus shown that the wave function does not provide a complete description of the physical reality, we left open the question of whether or not such a description exists. We believe, however, that such a theory is possible. The most famous scientist in the world blasting away at a well-known, if not well-understood, theory in such harsh terms made for a media frenzy, of course, especially when Podolsky leaked the story to the press early. "Einstein attacks quantum theory," blared the New York Times on May 4, 1935, several days before the EPR paper was published. "Scientists and two colleagues find it is not complete, even though correct." Einstein, furious, sent a statement to the newspaper in reply. "Any information upon which the article 'Einstein Attacks Quantum Theory' is based was given to you without my authority. It is my invariable practice to discuss scientific matters only in the appropriate forum, and I deprecate advance publication of any announcement in regard to such matters in the secular press." Podolsky's leak wasn't the only reason Einstein was upset. Despite the fact that his name was on the EPR paper, Einstein hadn't actually written it himself, and he wasn't happy with it either. Shortly after its publication, Einstein told Schrödinger that the EPR paper was written by Podolsky after much discussion. Still, it did not come out as well as I had originally wanted. Rather, the essential thing was, so to speak, smothered by the mathematics. Later in the same letter, he said that he couldn't care less about the uncertainty principle. His real problem with quantum physics had nothing to do with that. For Einstein, the crucial bit of the EPR thought experiment, once again, had to do with locality. If you measure A's momentum, you know B's momentum too. But because B is far away from A, then assuming locality, there's no way that making a measurement on A could have affected B immediately. B's momentum must have been set when A and B collided, just like billiard balls. But quantum physics doesn't let you calculate the momenta of A and B once they collide. Instead, the quantum wave function connects A and B in a strange way. Because of their collision, A and B share a single wave function, rather than having their own individual wave functions. But that shared wave function doesn't say what the particle's momenta are before a measurement is made. It simply ensures that, once A's momentum is measured, B's momentum will always be equal and opposite. According to the Copenhagen interpretation, particles don't have definite properties until those particles are measured. So if A and B have definite momenta before they're measured, then the Copenhagen interpretation is wrong, and quantum physics is an incomplete description of nature. But if A and B don't have definite momenta before they're measured, then the very act of measuring A's momentum must affect B instantly, in order to ensure that its momentum is equal and opposite to A's, even if A is in New York City and B is on the moon. And that violates locality. In short, quantum physics is either incomplete or non-local. This forced choice was what had been smothered in the EPR paper, according to Einstein. Einstein rejected any violation of locality, calling it spooky action at a distance, in a letter to Max Born. He pointed out that there was no reason to assume any weird connection of this sort. The facts at hand could easily be explained by the incompleteness of quantum theory. "When I consider the physical phenomena known to me, and especially those which are being so successfully encompassed by quantum mechanics, I still cannot find any fact anywhere which would make it appear likely that locality will have to be abandoned. I am therefore inclined to believe that the description of quantum mechanics in the sense of the Copenhagen interpretation has to be regarded as an incomplete and indirect description of reality, to be replaced at some later date by a more complete and direct one." Meanwhile, the rest of the physics community was shocked by the EPR paper. "Now we have to start all over again because Einstein proved that it does not work," wailed Dirac. In a fury, Pauli wrote a letter to Heisenberg calling Einstein's behavior a disaster and asking Heisenberg to write a reply for publication. When Heisenberg heard that Bohr was working on his own reply, though, he shelved his draft and let the master himself respond to Einstein's newest heresy. This onslaught came down upon us as a bolt from the blue. Its effect on Bohr was remarkable, said Leon Rosenfeld. As soon as Bohr had heard my report of Einstein's argument, everything else was abandoned. We had to clear up such a misunderstanding at once. Bohr immediately began crafting a reply with Rosenfeld's help. Normally a painfully slow writer, Bohr managed to crank out a paper replying to EPR in 6 weeks, an astonishing speed for Bohr, according to Rosenfeld, and sent it off to Physical Review, the same journal where the EPR paper had appeared. Bohr considered the EPR thought experiment carefully in his reply. He agreed that measuring A's momentum could not mechanically disturb B. There was no question of that. But, he maintained, there was still the question of an influence on the very conditions which define the possible types of predictions regarding the future behavior of the system. Unfortunately, it's not clear what distinction Bohr was trying to draw between mechanical disturbances on one hand and influences on the other. Was he saying that measuring A could immediately affect B? Maybe. Did he think that quantum physics therefore had to be non-local? Maybe again. There has been an enormous amount of ink spilled trying to decipher Bohr's reply to EPR. There is no clear consensus on what he meant, or whether he thought quantum physics was non-local. Bohr himself later apologized for the quality of his writing. Looking back, nearly 15 years later, he wrote that he was deeply aware of the inefficiency of expression in the crucial part of his reply to EPR. But he didn't elaborate on his response, except to say that, in the quantum world, it's impossible to draw a sharp distinction between the behavior of the things you want to measure and their interaction with the devices you use to measure them. It's unclear how this relates to the EPR argument, and it definitely doesn't address Einstein's concerns about locality. Despite Bohr's muddled writing, the mere fact of his reply to EPR assuaged the concerns of most of the rest of the physics community. Though most physicists agreed with Max Born that Bohr's writing was frequently nebulous and obscure, few actually read what Bohr had written. But whether Bohr himself thought the Copenhagen interpretation was non-local, most other physicists didn't. As far as they were concerned, Bohr's reply simply meant that the Copenhagen interpretation was alive and well, and EPR's accusations of incompleteness could be safely ignored. But Schrödinger was still unconvinced by the Copenhagen interpretation. Writing to Einstein after reading the EPR paper, Schrödinger said, "I am very pleased that in the EPR paper you have publicly called the dogmatic quantum mechanics to account." Schrödinger also pointed out something surprising about the EPR thought experiment. A strange connection between particles A and B, causing them to share a wave function, was not unusual. Writing about this to Einstein, and in several papers written later that year, Schrödinger dubbed this connection entanglement. Entanglement, Schrödinger found, is pervasive in quantum physics. When any two subatomic particles collide, they almost always become entangled. When a group of objects forms some larger object, like subatomic particles in an atom, or atoms in a molecule, they become entangled. In fact, nearly any interaction between any particles would cause them to become entangled, sharing a single wave function in the same way as the particles in the EPR thought experiment. Schrödinger's observation that entanglement shows up throughout quantum physics only deepened the problem for the Copenhagen interpretation. For any entangled system, Einstein's choice applied. Either the system is non-local or quantum physics can't fully describe all the features of that system. And Schrödinger had just shown that nearly any quantum interaction would result in an entangled system. Thus, the challenge the EPR paper posed wasn't limited to some tiny corner of quantum physics. It was deeply embedded in the fundamental structure of the theory. But Einstein's fears that the forced choice between non-locality and incompleteness had been smothered in the EPR paper were sadly justified. In a letter to Einstein, Schrödinger vented his frustration over how badly other physicists had missed the point. "It is as if one person said, 'It is bitter cold in Chicago,' and another answered, 'That is a fallacy, it is very hot in Florida.'" Einstein himself received many letters from other physicists vigorously defending the Copenhagen interpretation and pointing out where the EPR paper had gone wrong. But he was amused to find that the letters all disagreed about where exactly that was. Many were under the impression that the EPR argument and all of Einstein's problems with quantum theory were based on a desire for a clockwork deterministic universe, like the universe of Newton's physics. They might have been misled by Einstein's famous exclamation about a dice-playing god. But Einstein's concerns had little, if anything, to do with determinism. They were about the importance of locality and a physical reality that exists independently of anyone observing it. "Quantum physics," said Einstein, "avoids reality and reason." In his view, physics had been led astray by following Bohr. Writing to Schrödinger, Einstein described Bohr as a Talmudic professor who doesn't give a hoot for reality, which he regards as a hobgoblin of the naive. Yet in the eyes of most contemporary physicists, Einstein's concerns were irrelevant at best and misguided at worst. The English physicist Charles Darwin, named after his famous grandfather, said, "It is a part of my doctrine that the details of a physicist's philosophy do not matter much." Darwin had once been Bohr's student, like many of the physicists at the forefront of quantum physics research, and almost none had ever worked with Einstein. Thus, in the clash between the two on matters of quantum philosophy, most physicists were inclined to follow Bohr's Sunday word of worship, as the physicist Alfred Landy put it, while pursuing their own research on more down-to-earth subjects in quantum physics. After all, quantum physics worked, so why worry? The new theory allowed physicists to calculate and predict an enormous variety of phenomena with unprecedented accuracy, most of which had little, if anything, to do with the mysteries of entanglement. Other mysteries, more amenable to experimental exploration, beckoned, particularly the dark and powerful ones that lay in the atomic nucleus. Less than 4 years after EPR was published, those mysteries were revealed, and the world went to war. 4. Copenhagen in Manhattan. In the winter of 1955, Werner Heisenberg gave a series of lectures at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. The Cold War was in full swing. In the space of the previous decade, Heisenberg had gone from an enemy alien of the UK to a citizen of a trusted ally. Yet he was uneasy about his reputation among his fellow physicists and took the opportunity of his talk in Scotland to bolster it. First, Heisenberg preached the familiar gospel of Copenhagen. The idea of an objective real world whose smallest parts exist objectively in the same sense as stones or trees exist independently of whether or not we observe them, Heisenberg said, is impossible. How then does our world of stones and trees emerge from the world of atoms and molecules? The transition from the possible to the actual takes place during the act of observation, said Heisenberg. And what happens when we're not looking? According to Heisenberg, that question can't even be asked. If we want to describe what happens in an atomic event, we have to realize that the word happens can apply only to the observation, not to the state of affairs between two observations. And what about the measurement problem? What makes observation so special? Whatever it is physical, not psychical, said Heisenberg. The transition from the possible to the actual takes place as soon as the interaction of the object with the measuring device, and thereby with the rest of the world, has come into play. It is not connected with the act of registration of the result by the mind of the observer. Yet on the question of what constituted a measuring device and why it obeyed different rules than the quantum world, Heisenberg was infuriatingly unclear. Nowhere in his lectures did he propose anything like a solution to the measurement problem. But Heisenberg also made sure to leave very little daylight between his own views and Bohr's in his talk. Since the spring of 1927, one has had a consistent interpretation of quantum theory which is frequently called the Copenhagen interpretation. It was an exaggeration at best to claim that there had been a single, consistent interpretation of quantum physics since 1927. And it was certainly not true that anything whatsoever was frequently called the Copenhagen interpretation at the time. In fact, Heisenberg himself had coined the phrase just a few months earlier in an essay he had written for Bohr's 70th birthday. In both his essay and his lecture, Heisenberg depicted the Copenhagen interpretation as a unified body of work that was developed by Bohr, himself, and a handful of others in 1927. And in both essay and lecture, Heisenberg took it upon himself to defend the Copenhagen interpretation against its enemies. Many attempts have been made to criticize the Copenhagen interpretation and to replace it by one more in line with the concepts of classical physics or materialistic philosophy, Heisenberg warned his audience in Scotland. But, he claimed, this was simply impossible, ruled out entirely by the astonishing success of quantum physics, which could only be interpreted in one true way, the Copenhagen interpretation. The phrase Copenhagen interpretation was new, but this was hardly the first time that someone who had worked in Copenhagen claimed there was only one way to interpret quantum physics. Yet Heisenberg had extra reason to paint himself as an architect and defender of the quantum orthodoxy now. A common enemy had mended relations between the UK and Germany, and Heisenberg was likely hoping to perform the same kind of maneuver. Heisenberg's appalling activities during the war had nearly destroyed his relationships with Bohr and the rest of his colleagues. But the crucible of war had also radically reshaped physics itself. And luckily for Heisenberg and his precious reputation, these dizzying changes had made physicists much more receptive to the Copenhagen interpretation. On May 16, 1933, Max Planck, the physicist whose blackbody radiation law had set off the quantum revolution, met with Adolf Hitler. As the head of the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaft, the foremost scientific institute in Germany, it was customary for Planck to meet with new heads of state. Hitler had been chancellor for less than 4 months, and he had already seized dictatorial power over the young Weimar Republic, using the threat of domestic terrorism in the aftermath of the Reichstag fire as an excuse. Now, Hitler had passed a law decreeing that anyone not of pure Aryan descent was barred from holding any civil service jobs, including public university professorships. For Planck, this was simply a step too far. Surely, there are different kinds of Jews, some valuable for mankind and others worthless, Planck told Hitler, and that distinction must be made. That is not right, replied Hitler. A Jew is a Jew, all Jews stick together like leeches. Planck tried a different tack. It would be self-mutilation to make valuable Jews emigrate, since we need their scientific work. At the suggestion that he could ever need the help of a Jew, Hitler snapped. If the dismissal of Jewish scientists means the annihilation of contemporary German science, then we shall do without science for a few years. Speaking faster and faster, Planck recalled later the Führer whipped himself into such a frenzy that I had no choice except to fall silent and leave. Jews no longer had a place in German science, and there was nothing Planck could do about it. Germany's universities, all of which were public, had been at the heart of European intellectual life for over a century. Now, 1,600 scholars were out of a job. The burden fell disproportionately on the sciences, since 19th-century German idealist philosophy had sneered at the sciences as materialistic and therefore inferior. There had been fewer impediments to Jews advancing in the sciences. Now, over 100 German physicists were unemployed, a full quarter of all physicists in what had been the unrivaled center of the physics world. With a single act, physics in Germany had been destroyed. Einstein would have been the first among the newly unemployed, but he had seen Germany's fate coming. He and his wife Elsa had left their home in Berlin to tour the United States months before Hitler came to power. "Take a very good look at it. You will never see it again," Einstein had told Elsa as they left. Once the Nazis took over, Einstein, the most famous Jew in the world, was a marked man. Einstein's stepdaughter managed to smuggle his papers safely out of his Berlin apartment before the Nazis could destroy them. Hitler's goons ransacked the apartment 4 times in 3 days, but Einstein's family and papers all made it out of the country. Einstein met his family and collected his belongings in Belgium, renounced his German citizenship, then returned to the United States, where he took up a post at the newly minted Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. He remained in America for the rest of his life. Physicists who lacked Einstein's foresight but shared his Jewish heritage fled Nazi Germany after the Civil Service Act. They mostly landed in the United States and the UK, drastically shifting the center of the physics world and changing the international language of physics from German to English. Max Born was unceremoniously suspended from his post at Göttingen. "All I had built up in Göttingen during 12 years' hard work was shattered," he wrote. "It seemed to me like the end of the world." He and his family went to Cambridge for a time, then India, and ultimately resettled in Scotland for the duration of the war. As Hitler expanded his control beyond Germany's borders during the 1930s, more Jews who had the means to escape fled. By the Anschluss of March 1938, which united Germany with Hitler's native Austria, many of the great Jewish intellectuals of Viennese culture had left. Ludwig Wittgenstein was teaching in Cambridge, Karl Popper was a lecturer at the University of New Zealand, and Billy Wilder was writing lines for Greta Garbo in Hollywood. The best-known physicist in Austria, Erwin Schrödinger, wasn't Jewish, but his wife was. Schrödinger had been at the University of Berlin in 1933, but had quit in protest when Hitler came to power. After Hitler invaded Austria, Schrödinger publicly recanted his anti-Nazi views, but this wasn't enough for the new regime. Dismissed from his university post for political unreliability, Schrödinger fled to Ireland with his wife. Once there, he wrote a letter to Einstein, apologizing profusely for his great duplicity. Italy's Jews started to feel the pressure of the Nazi anti-Semitic policies after Hitler's visit to Mussolini's fascist Italy in the summer of 1938. The racial campaign acquired momentum at an amazingly fast pace, wrote Laura Fermi. We at once decided to leave Italy as soon as possible. Her husband, Enrico, was the pride of Italian physics, one of the foremost experts on both theoretical and experimental nuclear physics in the world. But with Italy unsafe for the family of a Catholic man and a Jewish woman, Enrico and Laura quietly made plans to leave. Their plans were complicated by Mussolini's fascist economic policy, which made it illegal to take more than pocket change out of Italy. Then Niels Bohr intervened. When Fermi came to Copenhagen for a conference that summer, Bohr took him aside and, breaking an unwritten rule of the physics community, told Fermi that his name was in the running for a Nobel Prize that year. Would the prize, which came with a $1 million cash award and an excuse to travel abroad, be useful this year? Bohr asked. Or would another time be more convenient, given the political situation? Fermi told Bohr that this year would be a particularly good time for the prize. Returning home, Fermi found that the Italian government had confiscated all Jewish passports, including Laura's. Pulling a few strings, he managed to get her passport back in time to attend the Nobel ceremony in Stockholm. After Stockholm, the Fermis went to Copenhagen to visit Bohr, and, finding the wheels of American immigration greased by the words Nobel Prize winner, they set sail for Manhattan just before Christmas, arriving on January 2, 1939. Well-established physicists like Einstein, Born, and Fermi were often able to secure new jobs in their new countries before they had even arrived. But the lives of students and younger researchers were far more thoroughly disrupted. "My heart aches at the thought of the young ones," Einstein wrote to Born in 1933. Einstein was soon involved with a British-led effort to help the academic victims of the Nazi regime, which met with some success. By the time Hitler invaded Poland and started World War II on September 1, 1939, more than 100 physicists had emigrated from the European continent to the United States and the UK, some of the younger ones simply fleeing, refugees without the promise of a job in their new country, coming with a single small bag across the Channel or the Atlantic. Some came with nothing. Some never came at all. John von Neumann, like Einstein, had made it out of Germany early. He and his friend and fellow Hungarian Eugen Wigner were both offered positions at Princeton in 1930. Knowing that the two men were unlikely to simply pack up and leave Europe, Princeton offered them half-time appointments. Visit Princeton for half the year, and then go back to their jobs at the University of Berlin, where they could lounge in coffee shops with Einstein and Schrödinger for the other half. Both men accepted the generous offer, but they had different opinions of the new world. Von Neumann immediately took to the States, holding dinner parties with his wife almost nightly, always in impeccable attire. Von Neumann once rode a mule into the Grand Canyon while wearing a three-piece pinstriped suit. Wigner was more reluctant to leave Europe behind, yet it was clear to him that he wouldn't be able to return to Berlin indefinitely. There was no question in the mind of any person that the days of foreigners in Germany, particularly with Jewish ancestry, were numbered, Wigner recalled. It was so obvious that you didn't have to be perceptive. It's like, well, it will be colder in December. Yes, it will be. We know it will. When Hitler came to power, Wigner and von Neumann simply didn't return to Berlin. Both men had been fired from their German posts, being of Jewish descent. Von Neumann and Wigner were two of a brilliantly gifted group of Hungarian Jewish scientists of their generation. Their astounding mathematical abilities and diverse scientific talents led their colleagues to jokingly suggest that Hungary was merely a cover story, obscuring their true origin. "These people were really visitors from Mars," said their colleague Otto Frisch. For them, it was difficult to speak without an accent that would give them away, and therefore they chose to pretend to be Hungarians, whose inability to speak any language without accent is well known, except Hungarian, and these brilliant men all lived elsewhere. Von Neumann in particular seemed almost inhuman in his brilliance. His colleagues at Princeton said that he was indeed a demigod, but he had made a thorough, detailed study of human beings and could imitate them perfectly. Von Neumann and the Martians did often think about things differently from their colleagues, including the foundations of quantum physics. Not long after he started visiting Princeton, von Neumann completed a textbook on quantum physics that became an instant classic. Other textbooks on the subject had been written before, but von Neumann breezily dismissed the best known and most technically sophisticated of them in the introduction to his own, claiming, accurately, that it in no way satisfies the requirements of mathematical rigor. The book contained von Neumann's subtly flawed impossibility proof, but this errant result was a nearly invisible blemish on what was otherwise an impressive technical achievement. Von Neumann articulated quantum physics in a mathematics as formal as his clothes, deriving well-known results from a handful of fundamental postulates. Among these postulates was one that von Neumann knew to be essential to the theory as it was understood at the time. He stated that wave functions normally obey the Schrödinger equation, but collapse on measurement. We therefore have two fundamentally different types of interventions which can occur in a system, von Neumann wrote. When an object remains undisturbed, the Schrödinger equation describes how the system changes continuously and causally in the course of time. But once a measurement is made, the smooth regularity of the Schrödinger equation goes out the window. The arbitrary changes by measurements, said von Neumann, are discontinuous, non-causal, and instantaneously acting. Here, von Neumann dissented from Bohr's view. Bohr held that measurement devices and other large objects must be described in the language of classical physics, and that this somehow accounted for the results of quantum experiments without invoking any kind of wave function collapse. Exactly how this worked was something Bohr and his followers were all unclear about, and this lack of clarity was unacceptable to von Neumann in his quest to make quantum physics more mathematically rigorous. Instead, he held that quantum physics applied to large objects as well as small ones. Quantum physics, in von Neumann's view, was a theory of the whole world. But this made the measurement problem far more stark. If normal objects are subject to the laws of quantum physics in the same way that atoms are, then normal objects can't collapse wave functions, since wave function collapse violates the Schrödinger equation. And if normal objects don't collapse wave functions, that would lead straight to the paradox of Schrödinger's cat. The punk rock particles from the introduction were in two seemingly contradictory states, a bizarre situation known as a superposition. And because their wave function never collapsed, they ultimately forced Schrödinger's cat to be in a superposition as well, somehow both dead and alive. Yet we only ever see living cats or dead cats, not a superposition of them, whatever that might mean. Von Neumann wanted to avoid this problem, which is why he had been so explicit about the existence of wave function collapse in his book. But this still left the problem of how and why that collapse occurred. Von Neumann's solution was to make the observer, whoever was looking, responsible for wave function collapse. We must always divide the world into two parts, the one being the observed system, the other being the observer, von Neumann said. Quantum mechanics describes the events which occur in the observed portion of the world, so long as they do not interact with the observing portion, with the aid of the Schrödinger equation. But as soon as such an interaction occurs, that is to say, a measurement, it requires the collapse of the wave function. It's not entirely clear what von Neumann meant by this. Some took him to be saying that consciousness itself causes the collapse of the wave function. This was a view promoted by physicists Fritz London and Edmund Bauer in a book they wrote several years later, heavily influenced by von Neumann's work. Wigner also adopted this view later. But this is a weird view. Stating that consciousness collapses wave functions does arguably solve the measurement problem, but only at the price of introducing new problems. How could consciousness cause wave function collapse? Since wave function collapse violates the Schrödinger equation, does that mean that consciousness has the ability to temporarily suspend or alter the laws of nature? How could this be true? And what is consciousness anyhow? Who has it? Can a chimp collapse a wave function? How about a dog, a flea? Solving the measurement problem by opening the Pandora's box of paradoxes associated with consciousness is a desperate move, albeit one that seemed reasonable at the time in the absence of other, fully developed solutions to the measurement problem. Strange as it was, von Neumann may have also held the view that consciousness is responsible for wave function collapse. But he sidestepped this question in his textbook. There, he claimed that conscious observers held no special status in the theory. The boundary between the observer and the observed is arbitrary to a very large extent, he wrote. Sounding a positivist note, he claimed that experience only makes statements of this type. An observer has made a certain subjective observation and never any like this. A physical quantity has a certain value. He also claimed that Bohr's work supported this dual description of nature. Yet von Neumann's view on quantum interpretation certainly didn't line up with Bohr's. Indeed, there was a wide gap between Bohr and the Martians, not only on wave function collapse and the application of quantum theory to measurement devices, but also on complementarity. Wigner had disparaged complementarity when Bohr had first unveiled the idea at Como in 1927, and von Neumann had made little use of the idea in his textbook. Now that von Neumann and others were questioning the Copenhagen orthodoxy on several fronts, a confrontation over the foundations of quantum theory seemed likely. But by the late 1930s, Bohr, von Neumann, and Wigner had little time to think about the foundations of quantum physics. War was obviously on the horizon, and new developments in more practical branches of physics overtook concerns about the philosophical underpinnings of the field. In January 1939, Bohr and his assistant Leon Rosenfeld took a steamer across the Atlantic, bearing to Manhattan the latest news from the continent. The German physicist Otto Hahn had split the atom. Bohr immediately tackled the problem. With the help of his former student John Wheeler, the father of quantum physics, set about unveiling the mysteries of uranium. The phenomenal power of atomic bombs ultimately derives from the delicate balancing act that is performed in the nucleus of every atom. The cloud of electrons surrounding an atomic nucleus is bound to the nucleus by the electric attraction between the negatively charged electrons and the positively charged protons in the nucleus. But that same electric force also tries to rip the nucleus apart. Like charges repel, and the closer together they are, the more they repel. A typical atomic nucleus is 100,000 times smaller than the surrounding electron cloud, which is itself a million times smaller than the width of a human hair. At such close quarters, the electrical repulsion between the protons in the nucleus, left unchecked, would send them flying off at nearly the speed of light. Instead, atomic nuclei are held together by an even stronger force, unimaginatively dubbed the strong nuclear force. The strong force binds together the protons and neutrons in atomic nuclei. Neutrons are electrically neutral, hence the name, but they feel the strong force just like protons. They play a crucial role in the nuclear tug of war between electrical repulsion and strong force attraction, aiding the latter without affecting the former. While the strong force isn't quite strong enough to keep two protons together by itself, adding a neutron to the mix increases the stickiness of the strong force without adding any electrical charge, creating a stable atomic nucleus of two protons and one neutron, helium-3. The nuclear struggle between the sticky strong force and the repellent electrical force ultimately depends on the size of the nucleus. For small nuclei, the strong force wins out easily, and adding more protons and neutrons generally just makes it stronger. But the strong force can act only over very short distances, comparable to the size of a proton itself. Anything much larger than a trillionth of a millimeter, a distance known as 1 Fermi, after Enrico, is too much for it. After a certain point, the nucleus gets too big, the electric force starts to win the tug of war, and nuclei become weaker as more protons and neutrons are added. Specifically, that point is around nickel, 28 protons and 34 neutrons, and iron, 26 protons and 30 to 32 neutrons. Bigger nuclei than that are less stable, and beyond a certain size, namely lead, which has 82 protons and over 100 neutrons, there are no stable nuclei at all. Uranium is far past that point. With 92 protons, it doesn't matter how many neutrons you add to uranium, it will eventually decay. But there are two forms of uranium nuclei that will stick around for billions of years before they do. Uranium-235 and uranium-238. The numbers refer to the total number of protons and neutrons in the nuclei. U-235 has 143 neutrons and 92 protons, for a total of 235. U-238 has three more neutrons, which makes it slightly heavier. But they're both uranium. The chemical identity of an atomic nucleus is determined solely by the number of protons it has. Chemistry is all about electromagnetic interactions between atoms. The chemical properties of an atom are entirely determined by the number of electrons it has. And the number of electrons that surround a particular atomic nucleus is determined in turn by the number of protons in that nucleus. Nuclei with the same number of protons, but different numbers of neutrons, are different isotopes of the same element. They differ in weight, but not in their chemical properties. Bohr and Wheeler, building on the work of refugee physicists Lise Meitner and her nephew Otto Frisch, found that the two isotopes of uranium have very different nuclear properties. Specifically, hitting a U-235 nucleus with a neutron leads the nucleus to fission. It splits into two smaller nuclei, releasing a fabulous quantity of energy, along with a few free-floating neutrons. With enough U-235, a critical mass, the neutrons left over from fission will hit more U-235 nuclei, which will split in turn, releasing even more neutrons and starting a chain reaction. Left uncontrolled in 120 pounds of pure U-235, a small sphere of the dense metal less than 20 centimeters across, a nuclear chain reaction would explode with the power of 15,000 tons of TNT, enough to instantly level a small city. Controlling the reaction by absorbing some of the excess neutrons would allow you to power a small city instead, for days on end, with the same 120 pounds of U-235. U-238 is a different story. Those three extra neutrons give it a little more stability, so hitting it with a neutron won't split it as easily. This makes it impossible to build a bomb out of U-238. And fortunately, about 99.3% of uranium in nature is U-238. To build an atomic bomb, you would need to separate the tiny quantity of U-235 from the enormous bulk of U-238. And since they're chemically identical, the only way to separate them is to take advantage of the fact that U-238 is 1.3% heavier than U-235. This guaranteed that nuclear power would be phenomenally difficult to achieve, acquiring enormous quantities of uranium and city-sized industrial diffusion and centrifuge facilities. It can never be done unless you turn the United States into one huge factory, concluded Bohr. Yet the risk of not producing nuclear power was too high. If Nazi Germany were to build an atomic bomb, the war would be over. The Einsteins and Fermis and Borns of the world would never be able to escape Hitler's Reich. A little bomb like that, said Fermi, cupping his hands as he looked out over Manhattan, and it would all disappear.
Can you guess where I found out about fission? In the infirmary.
Eugene Wigner had jaundice.
I was in the infirmary for 6 weeks. It was a wonderful period, because jaundice doesn't hurt, really, Wigner recalled. They fed you on potatoes, beans, and everything boiled in water, and the food was not good.
but the rest and the detachment were wonderful. Wigner shared the news of uranium fission with his visiting friend, Leo Szilard, another Hungarian refugee physicist who had realized the enormous possibilities of a nuclear chain reaction years earlier. Szilard was in Princeton, and he came to visit me every day, and we discussed fission problems and this and that. Well, the theory of Bohr and Wheeler, of course, occupied us very much. Szilard came to me one morning and said, "Wigner, now I think there will be a chain reaction." Debating what to do next, the two Hungarians enlisted a third, Edward Teller, who had settled in Washington, D.C. Over the summer of 1939, this Hungarian conspiracy developed a plan to alert the U.S. government to the fact that Hitler's success could depend on nuclear fission, as Szilard put it. Putting their plan into motion, they recruited a fourth conspirator, Albert Einstein. The Hungarians hoped that a letter from the most famous scientist in the world would get the attention of President Roosevelt. Spending several weekends with Einstein at his vacation house on Long Island, Szilard, with help from Teller and Wigner, crafted a letter to pass along to FDR. The plan worked, to a point. The letter did get FDR's attention, but he appointed Lyman Briggs, the ineffectual leader of the Bureau of Standards, to head a uranium committee. Briggs and his committee did little, and the project stalled for over a year while Hitler occupied Denmark, captured Paris, and relentlessly bombed London. When the U.S. government finally started to seriously investigate atomic power in the fall of 1941, Wigner met with Arthur Compton, an American physicist who was preparing a report for FDR's top policy group on the feasibility of developing atomic bombs. "Wigner urged me, almost in tears, to help get the atomic program rolling," wrote Compton. "His lively fear that the Nazis would make the bomb first was the more impressive because from his life in Europe he knew them so well." Several months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the American atomic bomb project was turned over to the military. It was assigned to General Leslie Groves, an administrator with the Army Corps of Engineers. Groves had just completed directing the building of the Pentagon, then the world's largest building, and protested his assignment. He wanted to be sent to the front. But once he learned more about the potential outcome of the work, he warmed to it. Groves selected the Berkeley physicist Robert Oppenheimer as the scientific director of the top-secret project, codenamed Manhattan. Under the peculiar sovereignty of the Manhattan Project, Fermi, Wigner, and other refugee European physicists joined their American colleagues at Los Alamos, high in the New Mexico desert, to build a bomb, racing against their German rivals. Many physicists at Los Alamos thought the Nazis had a head start on nuclear power, and they had good reason to think so. Germany had been the center of the physics world for generations, and America had long been considered a scientific backwater. Fission, after all, had been first discovered in Germany. Germany had also been in the war longer, and thanks to Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia, it had access to vast uranium resources. And despite Hitler's racist civil service laws, many good physicists remained in the country. Otto Hahn, the nuclear chemist who discovered fission, stayed in Germany, though he wanted nothing to do with the Nazis. Instead, he quietly continued his research, protecting his Jewish colleagues where he could, and corresponding with the ones in exile, like Meitner and Frisch. Hahn's friend, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Max von Laue, took his opposition one step further and risked his life by repeatedly and publicly condemning Hitler's regime from within. But most German physicists didn't follow Hahn's example, and almost none took von Laue's principled stance. And some, like Pascual Jordan, eagerly aided Hitler's regime. Finding the Nazi ideology appealing for aesthetic reasons and in line with his idealist stance on the philosophy of science, Jordan joined not only the Nazi Party in 1933, but also the Brown Shirts, Hitler's paramilitary stormtroopers. And other physicists, like Johannes Stark and Philipp Lennard, had been Nazis even before Hitler came to power, and applied Hitler's racial philosophy to physics, declaring relativity and quantum theory to be Jewish physics. Werner Heisenberg fell somewhere between the extremes of von Laue's conscientious objection and Jordan's full embrace of the Nazi philosophy. Heisenberg condemned the bewilderingly idiotic Deutsche Physik of Stark and Leonard, and helped von Laue in successfully ending the campaign against quantum physics and relativity in Germany. But Heisenberg also remained in Hitler's Reich, largely out of a sense of obligation and patriotism, and morally compromised himself by collaborating with the Nazis while simultaneously hiding behind the apolitical nature of science. He had been offered many positions across the United States and the UK in the 6 years between Hitler's rise to power and the outbreak of war, most recently during his tour of the States in the summer of 1939. Heisenberg turned them all down, insisting only that Germany needs me. While Heisenberg was not a Nazi, he left very little doubt about the depths of his loyalty to Germany, no matter who was leading the country. Leaving a physics summer school in Michigan early, he said he had to return to Germany for machine gun practice in the Bavarian Alps. Shortly after the war started, Heisenberg was, unsurprisingly, chosen as one of the leaders of the German nuclear program. The project floundered almost from the start. Heisenberg's grasp on experimental physics had been poor since his student days in Munich, and he made simple errors in calculating the relevant quantities. Though a brilliant theoretician, Heisenberg was always very casual about numbers, his former colleague Rudolf Peierls recalled. Communication breakdowns and clerical errors plagued the project. Interference from the Nazi scientific bureaucracy forced personnel decisions based on political beliefs rather than scientific talent. And a crucial realization that purified graphite could be used to moderate and control nuclear chain reactions escaped the attention of Heisenberg and his colleagues. After dismissing the possibilities of impure graphite, they instead focused their efforts on a much more rare and expensive moderator, heavy water, which slowed their progress even further. By 1942, just as the American bomb program was building up steam, the German program had come to a nearly total halt. In an army ordnance conference in Berlin in 1942, Heisenberg told his Nazi superiors that although it was unlikely that a bomb could be completed before the end of the war, a nuclear reactor held promise as a new power source for the Reich's war engine. Shortly thereafter, Heisenberg was made the de facto head of the nuclear program in Germany, despite the fact that he had never led an experimental team before in his life. Heisenberg's team worked on creating a controlled nuclear chain reaction up until the end of the war in 1945. Unaware that Fermi had already done it in Chicago in 1942, and unable to prevent a nuclear meltdown should they succeed and lose control of the reaction. Instead, Heisenberg had much less control than he thought. He hoped to make use of warfare for physics by doing interesting nuclear physics research with the blood money he received from the Nazi regime, even if that research handed Hitler nuclear power. Heisenberg had agreed to sup with the devil, wrote Peierls years later, and perhaps he found that there was not a long enough spoon. By December 1944, it was clear to Heisenberg that Germany was near defeat. Speaking with his colleague, Gregor Wenzel, at a dinner party in Switzerland, he wistfully sighed that it would have been so beautiful if we had won. He returned to his fission lab in Hechingen and made one last push to complete the reactor, but he was out of time. In April 1945, with the Allies closing in on Germany from all sides, Heisenberg was forced to flee from his research. He bicycled 250 kilometers in 72 hours, moving only at night so he wouldn't be shot by Allied aircraft, and made his way to his family in Uffeld. Days later, he was apprehended there by an American military task force, Operation Alsace, that had been sent deep into Europe to capture and interrogate the German